On Tech News Today, Microsoft's Cortana may be coming to an iPhone or Android phone near you. Plus, Twitter wants to be the first to own the second screen TV experience. And Google accidentally exposed the personal data of 250,000 customers. Nobody noticed for 2 years. Andy Anako's here, and so is Ed Bott. So stick around. Tech News Today is next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, March 13th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by LegalZoom. It's National Start Your Business Month at LegalZoom and the best time to create the business you've always dreamed of. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but they can connect you with an independent attorney. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code TNT in the referral box to save even more. And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 50-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. Tech News Today is a show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin. Christina Warren is off today. Our co-anchor today is Andy Anako, tech journalist for the Chicago Sun-Times, host of Twit's own Mac Break Weekly, and internationally beloved industry figure. Welcome to you, Andy Anako.
Thanks, Mike.
I won't mention your background or how awesome it is that it's
pixelated.
I know,
because the court sealed those documents for a reason. Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking. Oh, okay. Sorry.
Forget it. But I was talking about the other thing. Okay, never mind. Okay. Never happened. This isn't Meerkat after all. It's this show is not ephemeral. I've been meerkatting like a maniac, and if you're watching this show live, you can watch the Meerkat stream, which is much lower resolution, and you only get me. You don't get the whole show, but it's still a lot of fun, and so I think we're going to be talking about that a lot here and there on this show in the future. Well, what do you say, Andy? Why don't we jump into the news? We're here.
Indeed.
Don't look now, but Microsoft's Cortana virtual assistant is getting smarter and could get a lot more popular by rolling out to iOS and Android. Author and tech columnist Ed Bott joins us now. Welcome to you, Ed.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mike. And hi, Andy.
Ed.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Now, Ed, the Reuters interview that revealed Cortana's expansion to the iOS and Android platforms was very vague, as you pointed out in your piece, about the big question, which is when the heck this might happen. But when it does happen, do you think, and this is kind of a loaded question, I apologize for that, but can Microsoft expect fair treatment on either platform? For example, given similar access to apps and system events that Apple gives Siri or that Google gives Google Now?
I think that's actually the best possible question to ask about this. Cortana so far has been on Microsoft's own platforms, Windows Phone first, the Windows 10 preview currently, and the Windows 10 final release come this fall. They have the advantage there of being able to integrate all of the access to system services and system data that are available through the Windows platform, no restrictions whatsoever. If you talk about building Cortana as a personal assistant into other platforms, iOS and Android, you're going to be severely restricted in the things that you have access to. You're going to be sandboxed. And so the real open question isn't, to me, when, but rather how much.
Hmm. Now, Andy, do you think that Apple fans, iOS users, will be amenable to using something like Cortana? I mean, not a whole lot of users, I think. I don't think a majority, I'm guessing here. Use Siri, do you think that they may be inclined to try Cortana?
Probably not, because one of the big attractions of anything that Apple makes is that they make everything that you're using with this, and it will integrate with everything else on a really subversive level. When you even when you decide to do Google Maps instead of Apple Maps, a lot of people don't use it, even though Google Maps is still the superior product, because it's something else you have to purchase and install. It doesn't integrate with a lot of the other iOS experience that you have in the same way. So I think there'll be a little bit of resistance, chiefly because Apple users often expect things to just be working out of the box and never to have to download anything else ever.
In my opinion, as a Siri user, a longtime Siri user, and I've also used Google Now a lot, and I really love the sound of Cortana, it seems to me that
Apple has been very slow to develop Siri. I mean, they've been at it for years and years and years. It still doesn't have real agency. Before they even bought it, it used to be able to make restaurant reservations, and they took that out for a long, long time. And so I would think that if Microsoft can make this super, super intelligent, much smarter than Siri, that could change the equation. Now, along those lines, Ed Bott, what is Project Einstein within Microsoft, and what are they planning to do with that as it relates to Cortana?
Well, Project Einstein is an effort that's going on within Microsoft Research. And in the past, Microsoft Research has been criticized because it was primarily doing theoretical work that took a long, long time to make it into the products, to be productized, as they say. This looks like they've accelerated that pace a lot. And what they're doing here is trying to skate to the same place on the ice where Google is at. And integrate information.
Looks like we had a little Skype glitch. We'll go ahead, Ed. We lost Skype. Burped for a second there. Why don't you continue?
Okay. Well, they're trying to basically integrate the information from email, from calendar, from your search history, and from everything around you. Basically, your environmental signals that would allow Cortana to anticipate your needs. It's very similar to what Google is doing with Google Now, but Google Now requires access to, you basically have to be a consumer of Google services to take advantage of that. And this is a lot more inclusive of third-party services.
Andy, do you see, speaking of Google Now, do you see corporations integrating Cortana, especially if it gains, better intelligence? I mean, what I like about Cortana is the notebook feature, where you can go in and just very clearly see everything that it knows about you. I know that you can customize Google Now and to a certain extent Siri, but I love the fact that it just lays it out. It's kind of old school, where it's like, here is everything. Just go ahead and edit it. Could you see corporations, using Android devices, and then integrating, standardizing, I guess I should say, on Cortana instead of Google Now?
I could definitely see that, because they're two very different features. And every time I come back to Windows, I have to dip back into Windows Phone a couple times a month just to refresh myself. And every time the thing that impresses me the most is Cortana. They're doing things that Siri is just not, doesn't even seem capable of, and it's a different product from Google Now. Cortana's the one where you really trust this agent to simply hear what you want it to do and then for it to comply and do that thing for you. And if corporations can figure out a way to create enterprise apps that really take advantage of it, which is like just simply ask a question of you have a meeting with so-and-so in 2 days. The last time you met with him, you discussed this, and here's the emails that came as a result of that email. That's the sort of stuff that people are going to be very, very interested in. It's not a fun feature that you can have a celebrity on a commercial having a conversation with your little video friend. It really is getting things done sort of thing. And there's a lot of opportunity in Cortana that's really not in either of these other two systems.
And by the way, Andy, Martin E. in the chat room loves your background. So, Ed Bott,
you can take a drink. Every time someone says they like my background, I get to take another drink. So that's the new drinking game.
All right. Well, Andy Anatko, the future alcoholic, is now, okay, great.
You keep those complaints coming, guys.
Okay. You asked for it. We're going to get a flood. So, Ed Bott, oh, man. I knew I was in trouble when Andy said he would come on the show today.
I guess I'll have water with it just in case. There you go.
Okay, that's much better. So, Ed Bott, the improvements that we're hearing about with Cortana, of course, Microsoft occasionally will come out and make a big announcement, but they dribble out here and there. What other improvements do we know about or do we suspect that are coming to a Cortana near us?
Well, I'd say there's two to really focus on. One is the integration into the new browser that's going to be included with Windows 10. It's codenamed Project Spartan. We're not sure what it's going to be called, but the Cortana features are going to be integrated directly into that browser. So you go looking for a restaurant or a destination or start making travel plans, and additional details will be available to you. They won't pop up automatically, but they'll be available to you if you want them in an anticipatory way. I think the other thing to look forward to that is kind of the the secret weapon that Microsoft wants to have, especially in the enterprise scenarios that Andy talked about, is a focus on privacy and control of data. One of the objections that a lot of people have to Google Now is that, you know, the data is sitting on Google servers and you don't have any visibility into it and you don't have much control over it. You can take it out, but you can take all of it out, but you can't have granular control over it. And so I think you're going to see some differentiating features in terms of privacy controls as this rolls out over the next 3-6 months.
Now, Andy, among the major virtual assistant companies, Apple, Google, and Microsoft, I think that the company that really is living in the future at this point, at least in one sense, is Amazon, because of their Echo product. This is a standalone speaker. It has a high-quality speaker. Of course, their virtual assistant software and the database and all that stuff behind it is inferior to the other three. There's no question about that. But the fact that it's a standalone item, you know, I know that Microsoft wants to have people using Cortana with Xbox. But for people who don't have Xbox and for people like me who want a virtual assistant in the kitchen and in all rooms in the house and even outside, I just want to be able to talk like Star Trek to the computer and have answers come at me. Can you see Microsoft ever coming out with a device like the Echo? And that's a specific question. The general question is, what do you think of that model where you have, it's not just computers and phones and game consoles, it's also your house itself becomes a sort of an access point to these virtual assistants?
That's very much on trend, as they might say in Project Runway. Over the course of the past 20 years, the whole arc of computers has been to take this one big box that's in one room of the house or in one part of an office and simply break up all of its tasks into tinier and tinier devices. It's not about portability. It's about, let's build a compact device that is perfectly tuned for that morsel of computing you want in this specific situation. So it makes perfect sense for instance, your Apple TV to be a Siri access point so that if you're simply in this room, you have the ability to make a request for or call a call for information from your calendar and for that to happen, because maybe you're just in the kitchen in the other room chopping onions. You don't necessarily need to have access to your MacBook, but you do want to know, oh my God, do I have that conference call in 20 minutes or is it in 2 hours? So that makes perfect sense. When you talk about a device like Echo, it's kind of a negative sort of example, because this is a device that's designed to just be a speech interface to search. And it really does demonstrate, I think, that unless you have that hooked into your lifestyle and your personal information on a really intimate level, there are limits to how good it can be. Again, I want to be able to simply call out, if let's say that I'm married and my wife's name is Denise. It's like, is Denise running late? And because their permissions have been set in, it can say, okay, the GPS on Denise's car says that she is now 28 miles away. Also, she's on I-95 and she's been going at 18 miles an hour. So I think she's going to be very late. Do you want to call her right now? That's the sort of box that I would spend $200 for, but something that I can just, like in that picture that we just showed, everyone, all the family huddled around this cylinder in the living room saying, okay, Echo, what's 41 times 12? And if that were in gallons, how many liters would that be? It's like, okay, I mean, it's fun. It's a fun tech demo, but it's not going to integrate into our lives.
That's a great point. Ed Bott, you're always writing very well-researched and very interesting columns. Can you give us a preview of what you're working on next?
I'm waiting for the next preview release of Windows 10 to show up. And while that's in the pipeline, I'm working on a roundup of digital music lockers.
Oh, wow. That sounds awfully cool. Ed Bott is at edbott.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at edbott with two T's at the end. Thank you so much for joining us, Ed.
It's been a pleasure, Mike. Thanks.
Right. Thanks. Well, we got some more news for you in just a sec, but first, let's talk about LegalZoom. LegalZoom is the service that I've been telling you about all week that will help you save a ton of money on legal stuff, especially if you're launching a small business. It's Start Your Business Month at LegalZoom, and they got lots of help that will get your business off the ground? For example, what kind of business are you going to launch? What sort of corporation do you want to launch? What kind of name are you going to have? You got to make sure that that name isn't out there already. So you have to do an entity name availability check. You have to do a trademark search. You want to do all those things and do it right. And LegalZoom will help you do it right very inexpensively and very reliably, because they've been around for a long time and they've been helping lots and lots of people launch new businesses. They'll help you with your federal tax ID stuff, your seller's permit, the corporate supplies, the certificated copies, all these little things that you do. If you ever launched a small business, there are lots and lots of little things that if you don't do them right, it's a problem later on down the road. So you want to do everything right, get it together with LegalZoom. And of course, if you're just thinking about launching a small business and you're intimidated by all of the regulations and laws and taxes and legal stuff that you have to do, including website terms and conditions. You're just going to have a business based on a website. You have to have terms and conditions that are going to protect your business and protect your users. And so you want to do that right. And of course, LegalZoom will help you with that as well. Just go to LegalZoom.com and check out all the possibilities. And I think you're going to feel a lot better about launching that small business, because with their help, they're going to have your back. And of course, if you do need an actual lawyer, they're offering attorney consultations for only $50. They built a network of trusted attorneys to provide the guidance you need for your specific situation. So it's really a great deal all the way around. Just go to LegalZoom.com today and find out more. Attorney consultations are provided by independent attorneys, available in most states. Get the legal help you need for your business at LegalZoom.com. Make sure you enter the offer code TNT in the referral box to save even more. That's LegalZoom.com and use promo code TNT. Legal help is here. Mashable is reporting that Twitter is launching what the article says is a, quote, bold TV experiment, unquote, that could change the face of second screen viewing. It's called Twitter TV Timelines. The publication got early access to it, and they say the concept is very simple. When Twitter sees that you using a TV-related hashtag from one of their test shows, and those test shows are American Idol, Big Bang Theory, At Midnight, and The Blacklist, a notice pops up on your iPhone Twitter timeline and invites you to try a Twitter TV Timelines special interface. If you accept, you get that interface, and the custom view lets you follow Twitter chatter on the show and also see media related to the show, including pictures, videos, and vines. It's about darn time, Andy and Iko, because Twitter really is the social network, in my opinion, that's best suited for the second screen experience. You know, it's great to sit there and watch a TV show and an event show like the Super Bowl, for example, and then sit there and go back and forth on Twitter and see what everybody else is saying. And I just think it's amazing that it took them this long, but I'm looking forward to seeing it. What do you think about this foray into TV second viewing?
Yeah, when I read about this, I remember the old line about the political leader saying, "Oh, there go my people. I must ask them where they're going so that I can lead them." Twitter's big asset has always been that it really is free form, and people talk about whatever they want to talk about in a totally unstructured way. So this seems to be a way of Twitter being able to sort of get a handle on that and unify a conversation. There's no ads attached to it right now, but you don't imagine that their ultimate goal is simply to get people to use Twitter more. It must be, it's to gather people into a group so that they can be in the place where the ads will go at some point. It can't be overstated how much of a part of television now Twitter is, because it really is the only place where any random person can come in and join in on a national conversation about a live thing. So I'm kind of eager to try it out myself, because I do like participating in like conversations on like live events like the Oscars and the Grammys. You know, my own, you know, wise guy comments about how a certain actor is not wearing a proper tuxedo because that's not a real bow tie, that sort of stuff. But anything that could make that can really harness that a little bit better, I'm all for it. But let's see how it actually plays out.
Now, at the risk of talking about Meerkat too much, I think Meerkat has a really great model for how to represent text content associated with video content, which is that they put it right on the screen. The CEO, Ben Rubin, I believe his name is, of Meerkat, said this week that, one of the great things about Meerkat is that the audience is part of the content. And what he means by that is instead of the chatter going on about the video content being below or some, you know, scrolling off the bottom of the screen or whatever, it's right there on the screen superimposed over the screen. And I can see a lot of people really finding it appealing to have the chatter with their friends and also selected chatter about the show in real time superimposed on the screen. I mean, they already do it with ads and stuff like that, which is annoying. But I would love to see Twitter do partnerships with someone. I don't know how that would work. But to enable that so that the Twitter chatter, so that there is no second screen. It's the one screen, and you have all the chatter right there on the screen. Do you ever see something like that ever happening? And does that idea appeal to you personally as a viewer?
It really is about curation. I mean, I'm sure I don't want to see a fire hose of everyone who's using the same hashtag. I also have to say that I'm offended, lowercase o, not uppercase o, by how everybody's having this free-form, uncontrolled, uncontrollable conversation. But now the network that does the Big Bang Theory wants to have a foot in that, and they want to start to control the conversation, start to steer that towards purposes that will work for CBS. But I don't want the fire hose. If I have the ability to simply say, you know what, these four commentators are always really either really funny or really informative, or now here is a star or producer of the show that always has something interesting to say. I don't know if you watch Bob's Burgers on Fox, but the cast and producers and writers are often live tweeting during these shows, and I'm often watching right along with them. If I can have that sort of selected commentary as opposed to here's the fire hose effect, then, yeah, I'd be all for that.
I, as with so many things, I think that Japan is ahead of the curve here. They have a lot of, silly Japanese TV shows where they have a range of goofy and wacky celebrities who are there as a kind of surrogate audience for what's happening on stage. And they put their faces in little circles at the bottom of the screen. And so in addition to what's happening on the screen, you get the little facial expressions, the gasps, the laughter and all that stuff of those people. And so you can imagine this could recreate the experience of watching a TV show with a group of friends, but those friends could be in different cities. And I can see something like that happening as well. And I personally would love to see something like that. I think that there's got to be some way to actually recreate the feeling that you're in the room with a bunch of people when, in fact, you're all by yourself.
My one real worry would be that I love the old Columbo TV shows from the 70s, just to pick up one example. And they're such good television that I don't want any distraction. They're like a really good 90-minute movie with act breaks inside of them. My worry is that now when people are producing entertainment, when they're going to greenlight a series, when they're going to buy a syndication package, one of the questions is going to be, well, what's going to be the social component of it? We can't just simply produce stories involving characters and interesting situations. We have to make – people are never going to be able to pay attention to that. We have to have a ticker below it that's going to show live hashtags. I just I can't tell you how many times a cable show has been ruined for me because they decided to embellish a rerun by putting like a live ticker of people talking about it on Twitter. I really don't care about that. I actually want to see the show. I want to focus on what's actually happening in the program.
Oh, Andy, that's ridiculous. You want to watch the show?
I know. Let me go repair my buggy whips. I have to defrag my hard drive because my computer is so old, Mike.
All right. Well, let's move on. Google has accidentally leaked the personal information of more than 280,000 Google apps for work customers. The problem first popped up in mid-2013, but was only recently found and fixed. People have been exposed for nearly 2 years. The glitch was identified by security researchers at Cisco. It affects only those using the registrar Enom with their Google Apps sites. Some 94% of the website owners who opted into Enom's Whois privacy protection feature didn't get that protection, and their details were publicly listed. A flaw in Google's code revealed all that information, and Google released the following statement. Quote, a security researcher recently reported a defect via our vulnerability rewards program affecting Google Apps integration with the Enom domain registration API. We identified the root cause, made the appropriate fixes, and were communicating with affected apps customers. We apologize for any issues this may have caused. Unquote. And Yanatko, how did 250,000 people's personal information get exposed even though they opted in to a personal information protection thing and nobody noticed?
Because there are just so many – I have to admit that I'm not as up to speed on the technical details of this story as a security writer would be. But it just seems like this is the classic problem of so many moving parts inside a piece of machinery, number one, that it's easy for subtle problems to – this wasn't a problem that was causing things to crash. It was a problem where there is a chink in the armor that we're in a place where no one's going to look for it. Secondly, a lot of the people, even the people who work in security who – maybe should up their skills. They click a checkbox and they expect something to work. The next step after you do that is to test to make sure that your security protections are actually working. And it's this really is a danger to Google, because a lot of the covenant that they have with their users, particularly their business users, is that you're going to be funneling a lot of information through our service, our servers and our services, but we're going to take really good care of that. The reason why you want to trust us and not some third party that doesn't have our presence is because we have more experience. We spend a lot more money on protecting data than any other company does, collating and curating it. So this is sort of like, imagine if one of the big three fast food chains had like tainted beef in all their patties. That's like a disaster PR scenario, because once you can no longer trust the security of Google, you start to look elsewhere for better services. And that really, trust is at least one third of the product that they ship.
It's like finding out one of the things that you've been eating at Wendy's is actually healthy. The sense of betrayal would be overwhelming, I think. Well, in product updates, remember when Foursquare decided to become like Yelp and created Swarm to be like Foursquare? Well, now Swarm is getting a new feature, private messaging, which replaces text messaging, Facebook messaging, and calling. They also eliminated the plans tab, where you used to be able to propose ideas to friends about where to go and what to do. The new private messaging feature eliminates the shame of being turned down in front of everyone. Now you can be turned down privately. I'm always curious about this. Actually, Swarm is kind of a cool app. I enjoy it, kind of. And I'm a little curious about how Foursquare is doing with its sort of shell game of moving around the functionality. So I guess we'll find out at some point when they release the numbers of usage, engagement, and so on. But this sounds like a reasonable new feature, I think, for Swarm. Do you ever use Swarm, Andy?
No, I don't even use Foursquare that much.
Yeah, Foursquare has like become more like Yelp. They want to be more like a recommendation engine, and they're using, you know, they did a smart thing with Swarm, which is that they enable you to let your friends know where you are generally. So it's not like, oh my gosh, you know, I can be stalked. It's like, tell you generally what part of town you're in or what town you're in. And that's generally good enough. And it will tell you the distance. So it'll tell you, you know, a so-and-so person, so-and-so friend is, you know, within a couple of miles of where you are right now. So it's pretty general. And you can text them and say, hey, where are you? I see that you're, you know, in town.
I think the real difficulty of services like this is that people who are even in their mid-20s, early 30s, they didn't grow up in the same world that people in their teens and early 20s did. And therefore, the younger people have a sort of a natural affinity for these location-based broadcasting services. Unfortunately, this audience understands the sort of software and the sort of services they want. However, because they're 14, 15, 16, 17 years old, they don't have the expertise to create that kind of a platform and create that kind of service. So you have people who are one generation too old to understand this service as the only people who can build that service. So I think that's why you see a lot of these things coming out, and they have to be developed kind of by the Braille method. They have to be put something out, see what people are using, see what people are not using. And then a year later, you sort of start to, you know, shuffle the whole thing 80 degrees to the left because it turns out the thing that you thought was insignificant or just sort of a 10% user feature is actually what's going to deliver most of your audience for you.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, in mergers and acquisitions, TechCrunch is reporting that Amazon has acquired a company called Tulemetry. That's the number two followed by Lemetry. A Denver-based startup with an enterprise-focused platform to track and manage the Internet of Things devices. Terms were not disclosed. Andy Anatko, Internet of Things keeps popping up, and here I'm curious about what they're going to do, whether this is an internal thing or an external product that they're going to use this or apply the expertise or whatever, whether it's an acqui-hire, I have no idea. But they acquired this company, and they're getting very serious about the Internet of Things.
And I really wish we could do away with that buzzword completely, because I do think it gets in the way of people wanting to have a very specific idea for a product or a piece of hardware, but they're not. It's almost as if you're not allowed to simply say this is a way of connecting your lights to your heating system. Now it has to be an Internet of Things strategy, which means that it has to now be a platform, which means that it has to work with other people's Internet of Things product strategies and platforms. And now you have companies that are now buying companies that have the phrase Internet of Things in them. And now this company has to perform like a hot acquisition that justifies the amount of money that was spent for it. And because when you get down to it, I mean, I think we've all spent the past year and a half, 2 years getting pitches about IoT sort of things and making inquiries of people who are developing new hardware. And it very quickly veers away from what is this thing designed to do today? And it always steers into, here's what we're hoping to do when we get total master control system, control of every single device and reality on this planet. And it's a difficult thing to serve.
It is, and it's a great point that it's a terrible name, because, of course, some Internet of Things aren't actually on the Internet. They can network with each other. And there are, you know, it's just a very bad thing that's kind of confusing. But it is a buzzword. It's kind of like cloud computing a few years ago. Oh, you mean what you mean is that something's running on a server somewhere else. Oh, okay, so that's special and deserves an additional bonus amount of money to pay for it. It also seems unlikely to me that the industry that's behind the Internet of Things will ever agree on the set of standards that would be required to fulfill the vision of it. I mean, we can't even get, you know, our TV remote controls to the point where people understand, you know, everybody's got 12 of them and they don't, you know, people are groping for these things. It seems unlikely that, yeah. You know, one of the reasons we have so many great standards on the Internet is that all these standards, most of the foundational standards of the Internet were established before there was so much money to be made on the Internet. And so the people who established them were doing it purely for the vision of a united Internet with single standards. And nowadays, everybody wants to own the future standards of things like the Internet of Things. And so I think they're just, these companies just can be at war with each other ad nauseum to the detriment of users.
It's too difficult for one person to just do a crazy thing just because it's a good idea. You really do have to have that game plan in place if you want to get the money to make this really crazy but cool thing that you think can actually be profitable.
Absolutely true. More news in a minute, but first, let's talk about ZipRecruiter, our other sponsor today. If you want to succeed in life, you got to have good people working with you, because you can't do it all yourself. And the way to get good people is by using ZipRecruiter. The good people out there are everywhere. They're on job sites, all over the internet, and even social networks. And ZipRecruiter will help you find them with a single click. More than 50-plus job sites with a single click, and that includes Facebook, Google+, and Twitter. You can find candidates in any industry nationwide. Just post once, and the qualified candidates just roll in. You can create custom email responses when candidates reply, so it's a very appealing interface, and it will facilitate the kind of communication you want to be having with prospective hires. And with ZipRecruiter's premium traffic boost, you can get up to 3 times more candidates. So traffic boost will promote your job in special ways for 30 days. You can get featured listing in their daily job alerts sent to 10 million job seekers, and you can get up to 100 additional visits to your job posting. You can quickly screen applicants, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by more than 200,000 businesses. Right now, our viewers and listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. Plus, get 30% off your first traffic boost by going to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. Intel cut nearly $1 billion from its first quarter revenue forecast, saying that small businesses are not upgrading PCs as expected. Intel said it expects first quarter revenue of around $12.8 billion, about 7% lower than forecasted. Andy Anatko, I don't know if the PC is dead or not. It keeps dying and then coming back like a zombie. Intel, I think, is now the number one sort of bellwether of where the PC industry is going. Are you alarmed by this report?
Every time I see a report like this, I'm not really quite so concerned about it. Not that there's no reason for concern, because most of the reportage that I see that really predicts, oh my God, there's no one's buying laptops anymore, no one's buying desktops anymore, seems to be built on the understanding that computers are made out of marzipan and they break and they're designed to be used for a couple of years and then thrown away. When in reality, maybe one of the biggest threats to Intel is the fact that Windows over the past 5 years has become a lot more stable and a lot more flexible, so that you can buy a computer in 2011 and expect it to last 4, 5, even 6 years. And you also realize that unlike Apple, who's been seeing a lot of growth in desktop, people don't buy Windows machines because they're excited about Windows 10 and Windows 11 and Windows 12. They really do want to get that rental car sort of experience where I climb in, all the controls are where I expect them to be. It's reliable. It's fast. I'm good from there on. So it really isn't a sort of place where people are going to churn their hardware every couple of years. So whether this whether these numbers indicate a lack of reliance on desktops anymore, or just simply that people are holding on to are seeing the value of their existing hardware pay out over more years, I think that remains to be seen. I think it's kind of the second thing, though.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. It also is kind of prejudiced toward an old model of computing. For example, you know, one of the reasons for a while that people were saying PCs were declining was that people were using tablets like the iPad. Now the iPads are slowing in the sales numbers, and even Android tablets are sort of plateauing to a certain extent. They're not growing like they used to be. And everybody's like, oh, my gosh, this is terrible. And even though the reason for it is that a 2-3-year-old iPad or Android tablet works great. And instead of that being good news, that's bad news because people aren't just, like you say, burning and churning through these devices. And so, you know, is a tablet a PC? Well, what's the difference? If you get a PC for a person who can do all those same tasks with the tablet, then why is the tablet not a PC? You can put a keyboard on it. You probably can't put a mouse very conveniently to it, although you can with the Ubuntu tablet, at least when an Ubuntu tablet exists.
With an Android tablet too.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, what is a PC? Why does a PC have to stick to the definition that existed, you know, 5, 10 years ago when the nature of personal computing is changing, clearly?
Yeah.
And so
that's why Intel's new strategy of giving away Windows for free on tablets with screens that are less smaller than 8 inches. That's an interesting thing. I wonder how that's going to affect the metric, because I was testing out the Micro Center WinBook, the famous $60 Windows 8.1 tablet. I actually took it on. I was in New York all day yesterday. I had lots of work to do. I had to go to the opera that night. Okay, that was voluntary. It wasn't like a court ordered thing, but like I didn't want to have to carry a whole laptop like into the Metropolitan Opera with me. And so I didn't expect this little $60 tablet to do anything. But I'll be darned, it was able to. I was able to do all my writing, all my editing with it. I was able to run all my desktops apps with it. Dropbox synced to it pretty great. So maybe once we have Windows working on a different range of devices. Low power devices that actually are adequate for whatever task you want to limited put onto it, maybe we're going to see that number sort of change. There's a lot of flexibility in how we define computing these days.
My favorite thing to do is, you know, of course I have the iPhone 6 Plus, which is it's almost a tablet, it's a phablet. Mm-hmm. And my favorite trick is that I actually have a pocket in my coat that can hold an Apple keyboard, Bluetooth keyboard. I have a little stand that goes in another pocket. And I have the iPhone 6 Plus that goes in another pocket. And if I'm in a restaurant, I haven't tried it at the opera yet, but if I'm in a restaurant or someplace where I've got a few minutes to kill, I'll set up and I'm essentially doing, PC computing type of activities. Yeah. I'm doing email. I'm surfing the web. I'm running apps. I'm doing lots of things that you wouldn't have expected a couple of years ago that you could do on a phone comfortably. And it's very comfortable. It's very nice. I have a reliable internet connection and it just works for me. And of course, is that a PC or is that not a PC? And if it isn't a PC, why not? Why isn't it a PC?
Yeah, it's interesting to note that one of the breakthrough products that is ushering this sort of in, you could talk about, oh, well, now there's new range of mobility processors that have desktop class, but they use mobile sort of power draws. Or here's a new operating system that is more flexible. Now Apple has a better API so that you can do desktop class apps. When actually maybe the most important thing is that now people are making really cool folding pocketable keyboards that make you want to, I actually have a whole drawer of them that I've been reviewing over the once every 2 or 3 months. And now it really is, well, the limiting factor has been I can't really write 800 words like this, but I can take out this thing the size of a Pop-Tart, fold it out twice, have an almost full-sized keyboard, and then give it with the cost of a $2.80 hot chocolate at Starbucks, have a 3-hour office session that will be actually very profitable. I only brought the WinPad because I'm reviewing it soon. I was curious to see how well it would work. Otherwise, I would certainly have been just fine with like even my simple like Nexus 5 and one of these folding keyboards.
Which keyboard do you recommend, by the way?
Right now, there is an OEM keyboard that folds twice that you can't. It's hard to recommend a name because the different people you can buy 50 of them on Alibaba for about $500 or whatever. But you'll notice that it actually folds in twice like a barn door, so that the center section is. I can get it for you from the other room if we have more time. But the center section is like a completely interrupted space bar, and by the time these really complicated metal scissor hinges wind up folding, you have no gap between the left, right, and the center bits of the keyboard. It's my favorite so far, but there are a couple of nice candidates coming down the pike. Zag has an interesting keyboard that folds not this way, but it folds like twice vertically, like Venetian blinds. A lot of people are now that six inch phablets are starting to become the norm, and the Galaxy Note is one of the hottest phones you can buy. A lot of companies are trying to solve that problem of how do you make a comfortable typing experience in something that you could conceivably fit into a purse or a shirt pocket.
What I love about it is that a few years ago, these things were super popular. I used to use foldable keyboards with my Trio, I think, or yep. One of those devices. And Jason, while you were talking, Andy, Jason sprinted over and handed me this. He's very fast.
Yep.
This is a Palm keyboard. And, of course, this thing folds out like this and folds out, voila. You know, put that flat on a table. There's a little thing that props up the device here. It just goes in, and it's plugged in directly with a physical. It's not even a Bluetooth connection to this. But these things are great. I love these things.
Yeah, I happen to have the Zag like nearby, so I can. So this is what it looks like, you know, just folded up.
Yeah.
But then when you unfold it, it just turns into this.
Ugh.
And it is nearly a full size keyboard. Certainly about the same size you'd get with an iPad. It has a built in little kickstand for your tablet or your phone. And then when you're done, it just turns into this that you can easily put into a jacket pocket.
That is cool. I'm totally getting 500 of those. On Alibaba.
I'm going to see if it'll fit inside my dad's old like leather slide rule case, because that would be pretty awesome.
All right. Well, in big numbers today, we have a small number for you, 29,867. The reason that's a small number is because that's the total number of video subscriptions Google had sold by the end of 2014 in all cities combined where Google Fiber has been offered. Are you shocked by this, Andy Anako? That is a tiny, tiny number. I would have expected much bigger numbers. People are not signing up for the video service.
Yeah, I think they did. They just see this as a broadband digital solution. And the people who are excited about getting Google Fiber don't correlate that with a service that can actually give cable. And or the people who are excited about Google Fiber and know why it's so exciting are not the people who are subscribing to cable television. These are the people who have their Hulu subscriptions or they're torrenting the entertainment that they want. So I'm not terribly surprised by that.
Interesting. Well, in news you could lose, hold on to your hockey masks. We've got some Friday the 13th related news for you today. Warner Brothers announced today that Jason Voorhees from Friday the 13th will be a playable character in the game Mortal Kombat. Not in the base game, but in a downloadable pack sold separately for $29.99, which will also have other characters. Mortal Kombat X launches April 14th for the PC, PlayStation 4, and Xbox One. Nice. All right. Gotta have it.
So, do we not want to do the math and figure out, like, when I was a kid in the early 80s, how old was Frankenstein, and is Jason Voorhees now as old as that was to kids today?
Exactly. Jason who? Oh, man. Yeah, I'm sure that kids today are going to enjoy virtual reality horror that is vastly more terrifying than anything that we saw in the Friday the 13th days. Oh, man. Well, we got some cool feedback from a few of our fans on email, starting with Paul Franz. Paul Franz says, talking about our Apple Watch coverage, "Will I think about buying a $10,000 Apple Watch? No, I will not," he says. "But the Apple Watch edition is not targeted at me. It's targeted at a totally different demographic. It's for a market where there's prestige in owning a $10,000 watch, a market that would never wear a $700 watch, whether it's a smartwatch or not a smartwatch." That's a great point. Paul, we also got one from Gregory Dudek, who said, "Regarding the price of what the abandonment of the computer for the rest of us mantra, I could afford it, but I'm disgusting. This is far beyond silly." I think what Gregory is implying here is that Apple used to have the slogan some time ago that a Mac was the computer for the rest of us, sort of the people's computer. And a $10,000 or $17,000 for that matter, gold wristwatch is not a wristwatch for the rest of us. It's a wristwatch for the rest of them or the 1% or whatever you want to say. Frank White said that he was amused that during TNT that I read a letter from a listener chastising me for not knowing if $17,000 for an Apple Watch is a lot of money or not. The Apple Watch isn't a technology product, he writes. It is a piece of jewelry that happens to contain a tiny computer, just as a Rolex is a piece of jewelry that happens to contain a precise mechanical movement. I think that's a great point, Frank. However, the difference is that the mechanical movement will still be fully usable decades on, whereas the Apple Watch, although it may function if you can keep replacing the battery, you probably won't want to because the we'll move on to much more advanced forms, no doubt, of wearable technology. Andy, I know that you guys did the most epic episode of MacBreak Weekly talking about the Apple Watch announcement. But generally speaking, what is your thoughts overall about the pricing of these smartwatches?
You know, believe it or not, for an entire week, I've been writing one column that just talks about my thoughts on the valuation of that device because they're very, very complex. What I have to really keep coming back to, though, is that oftentimes the things you buy on an emotional level. I can't justify the fact that I spent, I spent $150, $200 on opera tickets, which is a silly amount of money to spend on 3 hours of entertainment that took a day out of my life, but I can't justify it. There's a plaster decorative bust in my living room right now that there are tens of thousands of these things made in the 70s. They probably cost about $15 at Sears Roebuck. If you go to find one of the Salvation Army, it'll cost maybe $2 or $3 if you can find it. And I spent like $50 or $60, $70 on eBay because it used to be in my parents' living room. And when we were closing down their house, someone smashed it to smithereens, so no one got to take it home with them. People might appreciate that I have an emotional connection to that plaster bust. But the point is that I should not have to explain to somebody why I wanted to buy this thing that I like and that I can afford. So while I do have a lot of problems, I suppose, for lack of a better word, with Apple selling a $17,000 watch, in the end, whoever buys this because they like it should not have to explain why they did it. And the other thing that I'm pointing out in this piece is that Apple has almost never been the computer for the rest of us. They're introducing a $1,300. I like the new MacBook, but it's $1,300, and you can buy something very similar in the Windows space that costs $600 or $700. Apple makes desktops that not that they're necessarily overpriced, but again, if you're talking about what they actually do, that you can save $500, $600, $700, sometimes $800 in buying the Windows equivalent. So I don't think that anybody who's attacking Apple for saying that this has never been, you're not the company that makes things that people can't afford. It's like, no, they're the company that makes things that they want to make, and they pursue their own ideas of how they would like to design things. And so there's a lot of really interesting arguments to be had around this pricing, though.
Yeah, and even the lower end versions of the Apple Watch are pretty expensive. I mean, your average Apple Watch is going to be about as expensive as another iPhone 6, and so they're essentially doubling. If you really want full, participation in what's happening with the iPhone, you need to now spend double the money because now the new platform is the combined watch and iPhone together, which is an interesting way to look at it, I think. And I wrote a somewhat related column recently talking about kind of trying to bury the argument that, an Apple Watch is pointless because it duplicates the iPhone's functionality. You don't need an Apple Watch. Of course you don't need an Apple Watch. You don't need to go to the movies. You don't need that high-definition TV. You don't need that nice car. We don't need lots of things. In fact, the things that we spend the most money on, the things that we spend money on that are the most profitable to the companies that sell them to us are things we don't need. And so, things we need, like food, we tend to go like super, get the cheapest, whatever we can get sometimes. But no, we don't. Nobody needs an Apple Watch. Of course, we don't need the smartphone either, for that matter. We don't need any of this stuff. Need is not the right criteria for judging whether or not this is something people are going to pay for. They're going to pay for it because it's a status symbol. They're going to pay for it because it feels good to use. The haptics interface, all the little things that Apple is doing with the watch, with the interfaces and how they work together is actually, I believe, going to feel good to use. Kind of like the iPad felt good to use. Nobody understood it until they tried it. And they're like, suddenly I need this. Well, no, you'd never needed it. It just felt good to swipe around on this big screen. And so that's my view anyway. And I think it's going to sell like hotcakes. My prediction is that they're going to sell more than all other smartwatches combined within a few days of the release.
Yeah. One of the great tests of any technology or almost any consumer item is that you fuss and you worry and you fret about the amount of money you're spending on this. If you've completely forgotten about that after the first 5 days that you use this, then you know you made the right choice. I like the Olympus OMD EM1 camera so much when I reviewed it that I actually went out and bought one. I have never bought a camera that costs as much as that in my life. But after 1 week of shooting with it, totally forgot about the money because it was exactly the camera that I wanted. And it enables my creativity in a way that no other camera ever did. So if it works and you can, assuming you don't have a credit card with 22% interest, then you forget about these things pretty quickly.
That's one of the geniuses of Apple is that they really good at minimizing buyer's remorse. If you're going to buy a Samsung, Galaxy S6, half the people who bought that are going to spend all their time going, gosh, I should have gotten the Edge. Oh, that looked cool. I'm not sure that I should have. And Apple, they have the big one and the small one, and it's like, even though, of course, Josh here had buyer's remorse on that one he was going back and forth for like 6 months or something. They're really good at eliminating that. I think, as you said, people are going to get the Apple Watch. And if it's as awesome as Apple says it's going to be, yeah, forget about the money. They're going to love it and forget that they spent a huge amount of money on it. Well, our TNT fans of the day are Julian Sammy and Chris Peachman, both of whom tweeted multiple screenshots of our behind-the-scenes Meerkat stream yesterday. And that's how they watched TNT yesterday. And there is one of them. That's the one from Julian Sammy. That was a lot of fun yesterday. I started with the drive-in, and my wife told me I shouldn't be driving while holding the phone, but technically it wasn't texting. I did a 4 or 5 hour one in the morning getting ready for the show at home, and then I did the drive-in, and then we got here and we did the whole show, and then there was the dog, and people were eating donuts, and it was an action-packed, very long Meerkat session, which by the way is called a Meerkast. If the thing itself is called a Meerkast. Anyway, that was a lot of fun, and those are our TNT fans of the day. How do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup, or a screenshot for that matter, and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook using the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT so that we can find it. And Andy Anatko, what are you working on these days? And tell people where they can find your writing.
Well, I'm finishing up, believe it or not, like about 8,000 words of Monday event coverage because there are just so many different topics to talk about. Part two will land today and about the new MacBooks, and the part about the Apple Watches will land on Monday or Tuesday. And then more keyboard reviews. I got a whole bunch of stuff that I've been backing up. The thing is, once you start writing a lot about one subject, everybody who makes these things and everybody who likes these things starts alerting you to things you had never heard of. So I got some stuff to write about. And you can find that at the Chicago Sun-Times site, suntimes.com, or go to subscribe to my Twitter feed at Anatko for alerts on things of that nature.
Wonderful. And of course, you are one of the stars of Mac Break Weekly here on the Twit Networks, which people should definitely subscribe to because it's really the greatest show there is about all things Apple. So you got to subscribe to that. Thank you so much for joining us as co-anchor today, Andy.
Thanks for inviting me, Mike.
All right. You can subscribe to Tech News Today from your podcasting app, of course, or you can choose another way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. You can also watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC at live.twit.tv, or on the app or browser plugin of your choice, which you can find at twit.tv/apps. You can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and you can follow me personally on Meerkat. Just follow me on Twitter, which is MikeElgan, and then find me on the Meerkat app, or you just follow my Twitter stream and you get a link directly to the Meerkasts that I'm streaming. Let us know what you think. Send us an email to tnt@twit.tv or call 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. My name's Mike Elgan. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday.